This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. The war in Congo officially ended in 2003, but fighting continued. In January of this year, 2008, a ceasefire was reached, but people are still dying, most from lack of access to food or health care. The death toll since the war's outset in the late 1990s has been put at more than 5 million people by the International Rescue Committee, an American aid organization. In January of this year, the IRC estimated that despite the reduction in the conflict, 45,000 people were dying every month, almost all these deaths from disease and hunger. In this portion of the program, we're going to get a report on Congo. Our guest is a former Associated Press reporter, Brian Mueller, who was based in Kinshasa for a time. He's traveled extensively in Congo. After covering the war for 3 years, he set out on a 2,000-mile journey across the country. Mueller tells about his time in Congo in the book All Things Must Fight to Live, Stories of War and Deliverance in Congo. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Brian Mueller. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to his reporting from Congo, Brian Mueller has reported from locations across Africa, including Kenya, Somalia, and Togo. His work has also appeared in Harper's and Esquire magazines. His book, All Things Must Fight to Live, is published by Bloomsbury. Our guest's website, www.brianmueller.com. And Brian is spelled B-R-Y-A-N. And Mueller, M-E-A-L-E-R, brianmueller.com. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to join the discussion this afternoon, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Brian Mueller, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Your introduction to Congo came in 2003 thanks to Susan Linney, the AP's bureau chief in Nairobi. And she asked you what you knew about Congo. What did you tell her?
I told her I knew nothing.
Yeah.
I'd come to Africa, and I was in Nairobi to do mostly travel stories. And when she asked me about Congo, I had really no idea what to tell her. Congo was the bad bush to me. I'd seen it on a map, and it just, you know, was these lost-looking rivers stitching through this jungle, and you know, guys like me disappeared in places like that. So I figured I'd steer clear, but it came the day.
Yeah,
she asked me, so.
She put a ticket in your hand,
mm-hmm.
and you're on your way.
Right.
I suspect most of us know very little, if anything, about Congo.
Mm-hmm.
What are the underlying issues of the country's problems?
It's a long history of rape and pillage, and it's been orchestrated entirely by outsiders. When the Belgians came in the late 1800s, under the rule of King Leopold II, you know, who had never even stepped foot in the Congo, you know, they pumped out the country's rubber and minerals and to fuel the Second Industrial Revolution at the expense of about 10 million Congolese lives. This pillage continued after independence when Mobutu Sese Seko took over the Congo, and, you know, he just kind of continued in those same footsteps. Milking the national coffers, you know, Congo is an enormously wealthy country, and
mm-hmm.
it's its curse. There's copper, coltan, diamonds, gold, and a mineral called coltan, which is used to make chips and laptop computers and cell phones. And so, it's its riches that it's its underlying problem, and kind of this scramble to take it. And that scramble and that pillage is still continuing today, and it still fuels the fighting that's taking place in the East.
Yeah. According to Human Rights Watch, the civilian death toll in Congo is higher than in Darfur,
mm-hmm.
Afghanistan, Iraq. The war has been called Africa's World War.
Mm-hmm.
It's been called the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Why has this story been so underreported?
Well, you know, during the Cold War, when Mobutu was president of Congo, the United States largely propped him up because we saw Congo or Zaire at the time as a democratic foothold in Africa, and you know, Congo at that time was surrounded by socialist governments in Tanzania, and then there was, you know, Angola, who had some Soviet influence there, and so we pumped so much money into Congo and into Zaire at that time. And then once the Cold War ended, it just kind of fell apart. We had no need for Mobutu anymore, and that's when the real problem started. Largely, why it's not very reported much is the you know, these deaths aren't combat related. These deaths aren't for brutality. These deaths are, as you mentioned, these people mostly die in obscurity on the forest floor somewhere in somebody's home, far from their own, after they flee the fighting and go into the jungles. This is, you know, the world's second largest rainforest, aside from the Amazon, and it's a very unforgiving place. And you know, just the slightest cut, or you know, a bout of diarrhea can be deadly for anyone. And you know, so when people are just dying like this, you know, it's not flashy. It's not anything exciting to report in the news. And it's been going on for so long. I think there's just, you know, it just seems like, you know, just kind of standard African misery. And it's really hard to kind of to lift that up from that bog, you know, that it's stuck in.
Yeah. What's the situation there today?
Situation there today, I think, is kind of static right now. There's still some fighting in the east. You know, it seems in Congo when one sort of problem is settled, another one flares up to take its place. Right now you have this renegade soldier named Laurent Nkunda. He's a commander of largely the Congolese Tutsis, and he has his own little kingdom, his little fiefdom in the east. You know, and he's been battling he has a breakaway militia, essentially, and he was a former rebel leader in the war. When the rest of his soldiers integrated into the National Army, he held out, and with a small cadre of fighters, which has, you know, turned to several thousand now, and they've been fighting the UN, and they've been fighting the government troops, and their soldiers just, you know, pillage that area. They rape women, countless women. And you also have about 10,000 to 20,000 Hutu rebels, Rwandan Hutu rebels, who are still in the mountains in the forest of eastern Congo, where they fled after Rwanda's genocide in 1994. And those guys, just the same as Nkunda's guys, you know, have committed hundreds of thousands of rapes across that country in the past, you know, several years. So I think in 2005, in South Kivu province alone, there was like something like, you know, tens of thousands of women raped in just 1 month, and that's the size of West Virginia. You know, so it's, and that continues, you know, even now.
Oh. Has the peace agreement signed in January in Goma been effective, and is it actually in place?
Yeah, it is. You know, I think the UN, despite a lot of setbacks and some stumbling the early years of their time in Congo, I think they're doing a good job now in keeping a lot of this fighting, in keeping these ceasefires going. But you know, these ceasefires are largely as powerful as the paper they're printed on, and these guys will, you know. It's a battle for loot, you know, and when one business deal goes wrong, you know, soon enough, then you know, the fighting will start again. It's not anything really complicated, and right now it seems to be holding. But you ask any Congolese if they really have faith in it, I'm but they'll tell you they don't. It really goes in these phases. It seems to me like I've been there reporting for the past 5 years, and so you'll have about 6 months where it's really quiet, and then 6 months where there's some really intense fighting. And I'm really hoping that this is, you know, with the election in 2006 and, you know, and the government kind of working to regulate a lot of the mining industry and regulate a lot of these mining deals that were conducted during the war, that kind of fuels this fighting. Hopefully, you know, people can go home and you know, leave the bush where they fled. And once people are home and working and farming in their fields, you know, there's a bit of stability there, and hopefully that's going to hold.
Mm-hmm. What's the situation with the Congolese armed forces?
It's one of the biggest problems, I think, of that country. What happened was, under the deal, there was a peace agreement in 2003, and that was brokered by the UN. And it basically integrated the rebel forces and the government troops. And so, you know, and you had the rebel leaders, you know, a couple of them became vice presidents under President Joseph Kabila. He's now the declared winner. He won in the election in 2006. But so what happened was you have all these militia, and this is still happening. This is a slow, gradual process. You have tens of thousands of these militia, former militia, joining the National Army, and, you know, ideally they would be trained and they would be, you know, equipped and, you know, and you know, sent out to expel the other militia that are still at large. But what's happened is the government hasn't really come up with any of their money. You have many cases of commanders in the field stealing a lot of the money that's meant to pay the soldiers. And so for the past several years, and I think it's probably gotten a little better, but, you know, you have soldiers dying of starvation, you know, on the front lines. It's, you know, starvation, like a National Army soldier is dying from hunger. And they're dying of cholera because their sanitary conditions are so bad in their barracks. And so when you're not being paid, you're going to go back to your old ways. And, you know, you don't blame them. These guys are former militia. They ruled by the gun before, and so they know what works. And so what you have happen is just these local troops just going berserk on the local population and raping and stealing. And it's gotten a little better, but, you know, not by much.
Yeah. Your introduction to Congo, your first setting down there in Congo for the first time, was in the east of the country, mm-hmm. and that is where the conflict is still most severe. Mm-hmm. And early in the book, you introduce readers to some boys there. They're drunk. They're walking down the street carrying taped-up guns. Some were wearing sequined ball gowns and wigs. Where was this? Who were these boys, and why were they dressed like that?
This was in Bunia, in a small little town in northeastern Congo near the Ugandan border. It's a big trading town, and it's the seat of the Ituri district of northeastern Congo. And throughout the war, you know, this war sucked in about seven different African armies, and these little towns like Bunia were largely the flashpoints of the front lines were drawn along these little towns because they held the trading routes and everything. And so I was there reporting a massacre. You know, there was two tribal militias at each other's throats and killing each other. And so I was there reporting this, and the Ugandan army, who was the last occupying force, a foreign army there, they were getting ready to leave, and these two tribal militias, the Hema and the Lindu, were really waiting for this power vacuum to happen, and they were going to just move right in to fill it. And the boys that I saw that day were these Lindu militia. And slowly, as the Ugandan army began pulling out of there, these guys started appearing on the streets. The UN at the time had a very, very small force in Congo, and, you know, they were trying to put in maybe 300 Uruguayan peacekeepers to replace 7,000 exiting Ugandan soldiers, and it just wasn't going to work, and these guys didn't have a mandate to protect civilians or anything, and mm-hmm. so the local population was just terrified already. And then here come these boys, and most of these kids, you know, they belong to this militia, and their parents have been murdered in these massacres, or the parents don't have any money to take care of them. It's largely the case in a lot of African countries that are at war. And, yeah, and a lot of them believe in magic, you know, they're told by these, you know, these commanders that they have that, you know, if they take these drugs, they smoke this weed or drink the beer, you know, or a lot of them wear these little fetishes on their arm, then they'll become bulletproof, and a lot of them believe it. And another form of this anti-bullet is sort of this battle gear. And they wear these fright masks, these kind of clear plastic masks, and they'll also wear some, I saw some guys wearing, blonde, these kind of punked out blonde yellow wigs and these sequined ball gowns, and it's a really startling image. I didn't see it much after that in Congo, but, in wars in Liberia later on that summer in 2003, the front lines were just packed full of these kids in drag. What they believe is it creates this second identity, and if they dress up in a mask and a costume, then the bullets will hit the second identity and not them. And I guess the kids who were killed, their comrades maybe believe that they didn't believe it enough, I guess, or something.
Yeah.
But it's a really startling image, and it's one thing that really stands out in my memory of those days in 2003.
Is it also a way to pull yourself out of the horror to dress in a character? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, these kids are terrified as well, and they, I met this one kid. He wasn't dressed up in drag. A little bit he was, but he had seen his parents murdered at this massacre in Drodro, which is a little town north of Bunia, and it had caused him to stutter. He had this constant stutter. He couldn't even speak anymore. And this kid was, I think, certifiably crazy at that time. His eyes, they were just bugging out as if he were on speed or something. And I watched him drag two women out of a shop. He thought they were looting and just, like, beat them with his gun. And this kid was 10 years old. And when you see kids behave like that way, you realize really quickly that these kids are so young and they're so damaged that they have really no value for human life anymore. And I was largely more terrified of these kids than I was like the older warriors, because I think they just didn't care. They didn't have any value of what life was and how easily it's expendable. And in Congo, the Congo War and a lot of wars in Africa are fought by these people, by these kids like this, which makes them so terrifying.
How many orphans do you suppose there could be in Congo?
Oh, hundreds of thousands. I mean, if you think there's 5.4 million killed over the past 10 years, there may be a million orphans. It's hard to always tell because the African family unit is so tight, and it's also a lot really hard to gauge sometimes the displaced because you have. When people are displaced, they'll take off into the bush, and they'll just go live with family members or friends or distant cousins or so a lot of times people have homes, but it's not their real home, and soon their presence there exhausts like the finances of people of their host, and so it's really hard to tell. A lot of these, one of the ways you can tell the orphans, I guess, is going to the armed forces, because I think a lot of these orphans do become militia soldiers. And army soldiers, and it's really the only way for them, and it's really not a better life, after the death of their parents.
Mm. What's the life expectancy for these kids?
Yeah. I wouldn't say it's very high. I wouldn't say the life expectancy for the average Congolese isn't very high. You see some old people, but not many, and you walk into these camps, where these people have fled fighting, and there's 25,000 people kind of gathered in this little hook of a valley, and they're just dying by the dozens per day. They go there fleeing, some militia raid or whatever, and they're just dying of a cough. They're dying of they drink dirty water, and these kids are just dropping out. And you look at this, and you just look how fragile life is, and you also worry about your own self as well, because there's no doctors around anywhere. And I think that's really inspired the title of my book as well. Life is a struggle in every way in that place, and to live as a man and have a family and a wife that you have that's still together, a family unit that's together, that's an enormous achievement and something to be really proud of. And you see it in Congo, in the West, in places where there isn't a lot of fighting, but you don't really see it a lot because so many people have died, and every person, every family has been touched by that war and has lost family members from that war. And many villages I go to, they always talk of dead kids. Children have it the hardest, And that country and that war fight them every inch of their lives, every day. It's like a blade on their heels with every step.
Hmm. What's Congo's future?
Congo's future is very bright if the government and the international community work together to kind of staunch the graft that's happening right now, or that has happened for over the past 60 years. As I said, this is one of the most wealthy nations in Africa. The Congo River can provide electricity for, I think, the third of the continent. But yet, hardly anybody in Congo has electricity. The gold, the cobalt, the coltan, the diamonds, the timber. I mean, it's just so textured and so rich. And, one day the Congolese people will see what their minerals and their timber and their coffee and we'll buy them. The Chinese have come in the past several years. They've been there for a while now, but they just recently signed a $9 billion deal with the government, where the government gives them, lets them sit over these cobalt and copper mines to their heart's content, while in exchange for providing, 2,000 miles of railway, 2,000 miles of road. The Chinese are going to also build dozens of hospitals and universities and clinics, which is, more than Mobutu and the Belgians or anybody else could have done in 100 years, and these guys are going to do it in 3. So you have to ask, these guys are taking the minerals anyway, but if they can actually come in and give back and connect some of these markets, because in Congo there are no roads. It's it's just dense jungle, and when you go into the east, it's hills and just rough valleys, and to have a road that connects, these are small things that we take for granted here. A road that connects one side of the country to the next is going to ignite an economy along that line, and these markets are going to blossom. And when people have jobs and when people have money, they don't want to join militias, and they can have stronger social networks, and they can have, these villages can come together, and they can be strong. They don't have to flee every 3 weeks from fighting, and they can stand up to soldiers who come and rape them, and try to steal from them, and so it's only good when you have infrastructure and when you have stability, which seems to be trying to hold in Congo right now. You have power. And hopefully that will come about for the Congolese people. And I think one of the things we do take advantage of is a sense of dignity. People need their dignity back. They've never had it in their lives. And if you think of, it's just really a small thing to ask for, a man to go to work and be paid for his job. And I think every man just wants to go to work and be paid. And in Congo, that hasn't really been a reality for about the past 60 years. So.
Is China holding out an example for the rest of the world, the EU, the United States? I mean, if they can go in and put 2,000 miles, 200,000 miles, what did you say?
It's 2,000 miles.
2,000 miles of roads, why can't other people step up to the plate and say, well, we could put 2,000 miles in too? And then the other question I have for you is then, is this work underway and are Congolese people being employed on these projects, building clinics, building hospitals, building roads?
The first question, I think it's a wonderful example. There's American mining companies in Congo right now. Phelps Dodge, who's owned by Freeport-McMoRan, they have one of the biggest cobalt and copper concessions in all of Congo in the southern Katanga province, and they've gone in and they're building, hospitals and stuff like that. But this is on a small scale. China, for all of its faults, I would say a large amount of the weaponry that's in the hands of these militia probably came from China. Mm. In fact, I know it came from China. But for all of its faults, these guys, to the Congo, to the Chinese, it's always about business. It's just about business. And it's a good deal. And I think, I really hope it does influence other people to come in and do it. There's just so much stuff tied into development, For so long, there's just this there's been this culture of assistance and aid, but when you get into development, it's a lot more red tape, and with NGOs and stuff, and for some whatever reason, the Chinese just bypassed all that stuff, and they go and they're going to build stuff, whether it's maintained, whether it's good quality, I don't know, you know, who knows. Mm. But the fact that the I think just the gesture alone is amazing. And, you know, a lot of people say that, you know, the Chinese are, a lot of critics have already come out and said the Chinese are the new colonialists or whatever. Well, you know, I think that's really bogus. This is a good deal for the Congolese. It can't be anything but a good deal for the Congolese. You know, I was on this train ride and across the country, and I was in a train full of people who hadn't seen their family members in 10 years since the war started. They were fighting for the first time going home. And you find those stories all over Congo. These people who, you know, because there's just no way to get across that country. Airfare is just so out of reach for so many people. They can't even go 300 miles. You know, they're stranded 300 miles away from their daughter, who they haven't seen in 10 years, or their mother, or their brother, or their sister, or the job that they used to have. And, you know, all it really takes is a road or, you know, a railway working again. And that's how you bring up. That's how you build a country back. The second part of your question, yes, they will be working with the Chinese. I think what I read just some news report recently, there's going to be one Chinese supervisor per 10 Congolese or something. I don't know, something like that. But the Congolese will be employed to do this.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking about Congo this afternoon. Our guest is former Associated Press reporter Brian Mueller. He was based in Kinshasa for some time. He's traveled extensively in Congo. After covering the war for 3 years, he set out on a 2,000-mile journey across the country by boat, train, bicycle, and on foot. He tells the story of his time in Congo in the book All Things Must Fight to Live: Stories of War and Deliverance in Congo. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. Well, back to the story of the boys, the Lendu boys, mm-hmm. that you met up with in your first venture into Congo. There was another, then early in the book there, we also are introduced to a fellow by the name of Jean-Pierre. Tell us a little bit about him, and then the question I have for you then is, you know, how did you begin to try to make sense of who was who and what was what?
Jean-Pierre, you meant the guy with the briefcase.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went to Bunia to cover this massacre, as I said earlier, and also, you know, as I was there, these militia started kind of closing in on the town as the Ugandans were preparing to leave. And we would wake up every day. And at the time, I was the only Western journalist in the town. There would later be a lot of Western journalists coming in. But I was just there for some really small thing, you know. And I really found myself being, you know, I was covering a story, and it, you know, as the old line goes, it began to cover me. Every day we would wake up, and I would wake up, and there would be new dead bodies. There would be bodies in the street. There would be, you know, somebody hanging from a tree. Women were being raped in the outer neighborhoods. At night, I would go to sleep to gunfire, and it would encroach a little closer to my room. And you know, I'd never been in a situation like this before, and it was terrifying. And I was by myself, and I was inexperienced, and I had no idea what to do. I wasn't working for the AP then. I was a freelancer.
Mm-hmm.
I was there for, I was going to do a magazine story. And so, you know, I'd been living in Manhattan before this, you know. And so as these people were turning up dead, a lot of motorcycle taxi drivers were in particular being targeted for whatever reason. And one afternoon, you know, every day a few times a week, I would get a visit at my hotel by this man named Jean-Pierre. and Jean-Pierre wore this little boxy suit and tie. He was very well dressed. And he carried this briefcase full of photos of dead bodies that he would photograph, or whoever would photograph, and he would sell to the journalists who were passing through, either the African journalists or the Western journalists. And I don't know anybody who ever bought these, but these pictures were pretty grisly and ghastly. You know, you would have photos of people with their torsos torn open and their organs removed. That was a common practice of these militias. After they would kill people, they would eat from the hearts and livers. And so you would have photos of that. You would have photos of these warriors dressed up with these bow and arrows and spears. And they were just frightening photos, and just I was fascinated by them. I was fascinated by the fact that he had them. And there was one photo that particularly caught my attention one day. It was one of these taxi drivers, and he was laying in the road, and a big gash across his neck, and you know, his eyes were open and staring at the sky. And usually, you know, he would sell these for about $20, and I'd said, I was like, how much is this one? And he goes, it's 30. I said, 30? Why is it 30? You know, why not 20? And he goes, monsieur, this man is still lying in the road. And, you know, he took this photo and had it developed, and this body is still lying out there in the road. And so these characters would come around, and I you never knew who to trust. At that time, I'll try to give some background. It's really complicated. The Hema and the Lindu are these two tribes that existed in that area. They've been there for hundreds of, you know, maybe 1,000 years even, and they've existed in harmony throughout this time. And whenever, about in 97, they started this land dispute. A really wealthy Hema businessman seized a bunch of Lindu land. And at the time, the Hema were really favored by Mobutu's regime and the Belgians before him. And so, you know, this land was just taken by this Hema businessman, and there's nothing these Lindu people could do. They were largely uneducated and had no real power in the government or anything. And so as Mobutu empire is crumbling, these Hema guys are just claiming land out throughout Ituri. And so the Lindu come in, and they get a vigilante army of their warriors, and they just start attacking these Hema villages and killing them by the hundreds. And then so when the Ugandan army came in the war in 98, along with the Rwandans, they really exploited these tensions between these two groups and started arming and training these guys, these two tribal militias, and you know, giving them guns and weaponry. And then when one relationship would spoil, they would go and fund the other one. And so pretty soon these guys started turning on the other. And so you never really knew, you know, as a white Western guy, I can't tell who's a Hema and who's a Lindu. You know, it was largely, it's the same, in, you know, these tribes are all related to the Tutsi and the Hutu of Rwanda. The Hema is related to the Tutsi, the Hutu is related to the Lindu. You know, white men drew these borders. You know, these tribes are all interconnected, and you know, Rwanda sits on the border with Congo. And so, you know, it's the same as the situation in Rwanda. You know, the Hema, they were really out to get the Lindu, and Lindu were out to get the Hema. And so you never really knew who, when you hired people, taxi drivers, when you hired translators, when you bought photos from some guy, and you're the only guy there in the town, you don't know who you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And I was so naive. I was so green. You know, I showed up on the airport my first day in Bunia and started saying in English, anybody know where I can find a translator? You know, it was such a rookie move. And that really paid off for me, actually. Fortunately, you know, I found a really good guy named Johnny Ngure. And he was actually from a neutral tribe, the Allure, and as was subsequent translators. I try to stick with the Allure guys. But you don't know. And when the gunfire is going off at night and you're laying in your bed counting the shots, and you don't know if they're coming after you, you have no idea. They weren't. And we were fortunate as journalists in Congo that we were never really targeted, as you know, a lot of my colleagues are in Iraq or Afghanistan. But you don't know. You don't know this. And as a young, green reporter in this place like this, this really, truly terrible, evil place, you know, I was pretty scared, you know.
Yeah.
I would, and paranoia ruled, you know. It put me in bed at night and woke me up in the morning. So.
So why didn't you leave and never go back?
Because it was a good story. It was a good story. And I was holding out to go cover this massacre. I convinced this editor in New York to send me to Drodro to cover this massacre that I'd initially gone to cover. I'd come back to chronicle it, blow by blow, as it were, but to really report it as something as if it had happened in Cleveland or something. In this massacre, 1,000 people were killed in 3 hours by Lindu warriors. A lot of these, these young child soldiers with machetes and guns. And imagine, that's 1,000 people in 3 hours who are butchered to death. That number just blew my mind, and the act of it blew my mind, and I was really drawn to it, and I wanted to go back, and I wanted to just really write it as if it happened in my city or in your city, and have people to relate to the story and get beyond the African names and get beyond the academic statistics that usually you read with coverage of Africa or something, and. So I was waiting to go in with these forensic anthropologists. We're gonna, these forensic experts were gonna go in and dig up these mass graves, and I really wanted to go, and I didn't want to leave Bunia because I still was in my head. I was thinking that I was still gonna go in with these forensics guys, and I did eventually, but. Bunia, in the meantime, was slowly, it was this town sentenced to death. And sure enough, as soon as the Ugandans left on May 6th, 2003, the Lindu attacked the town several hours later and killed about 600 people in the streets over about the next week. I was able to beg a flight on the Ugandan general's plane and escaped with about 3 hours to spare. And I kid you not, as we flew up and over Bunia, leaving to go back to Uganda, I saw these guys marching into town, and my heart nearly came out my shoes.
Yeah. So. The Ugandans, on the one hand, I mean, I have this sense that, hooray, the Ugandans are here, and then on the other hand, oh God, the Ugandans are here. They were cops, but they weren't the best cops. Also, the UN... people had to know what would happen, even if, the bad cops were leaving town. Why did that happen?
It was a really poorly executed withdrawal, a poorly executed. Everything went wrong. The UN had no. The UN had a really weak mandate in all of Congo. Their peacekeepers, they had a really small presence there at the time. And in areas where the war had ended, this was a war that encompassed a country three times the size of Texas. The Congo is the size of the United States east of the Mississippi River. I mean, that's a huge place. And this war encompassed every corner of that country at one time or another. And the war had ended. By the time I got there in 2003, that war was over. In most of that country, it was still going on in the east where I was, and this mandate really worked swell for those places where the war had ended. But this was another front, and this was a largely this is a really brutal front of the war. It was really macabre, and I use the word evil, but it just was. It wasn't frontline fighting like you saw in other parts of the country. It was just brutality. It was massacres. And mutilation and rape, and it was just terror, just absolute terror. And the UN came in, and I think they were interested in the bottom line. These decisions were coming from New York. They weren't coming from Kinshasa or from Bunia. People in Kinshasa or from Bunia were really desperate for these guys to bring in more peacekeepers and to beef up their mandate. To protect civilians. Their mandate only let them protect their own staff and their own property. And so when the Ugandans were leaving, the Ugandans, as you said, yeah, they were dirty cops. They had come in there and they'd started this whole thing. They had, armed and trained these guys. A lot of the Congolese didn't know that. And the thing is, there's so much rumor in that place and so much innuendo and so much just hearsay and you never really knew what was happening there. You ask one person, who committed this massacre in Drodro? And they'll say, there were all Ugandan soldiers. They were dressed in Ugandan soldier outfits. Well, we also knew that, when the Lindu would fight the Ugandans and kill their soldiers, they would rip their, they often took their uniforms and wore them. So you never really knew, but who am I to say that the Ugandans didn't help orchestrate this massacre? I don't know. You know, at the time they were against the Hema. So I have no idea. And so, but at the same time, they were also preventing further massacres from happening. Mm-hmm. This is true. But I think at the time, the UN were only interested in this bottom line of, you know, we have the Rwandans have already left, the Namibians have left, the Angolans, the Zimbabweans, everybody's left, and now you guys have to leave. And then the country will be at peace and everybody can get back to their normal lives again. Well, when the Ugandans started pulling out, there was a big parade and people were cheering them leaving, and they even took with them some Congolese wives back to Uganda. People were afraid when they were leaving. You know, half, like I said, half the people were happy, half the people were really terrified, because people thought when they saw United Nations peacekeepers come in with the blue helmets and the blue flak vest, and they had guns, they had these M16s, and they thought, okay, well, these people are here to protect us. You know, we have an army here. They don't, in their mind, they didn't know what these mandates were. You know, you try to explain to them, and the color would just drain from their face. You'd say, these people aren't here to protect you. They're not going to protect you. Oh no, you're lying. You can't be. That can't be true. These people have guns. They're here to protect us. They have the guns, and you try to explain to them, and they don't believe you. And what happened was, this started to catch on, because on maybe 3 days before the withdrawal, there was a big gunfight that I was caught up in, and the Lindu and the Hema militia started fighting each other, and the UN did nothing. The UN didn't bring anybody. They got in their APCs and they hightailed it to their base. And when the people really saw that. Because people were being killed in the streets, and there was a lot of grenades going off, and there was some mortars being shot, and the Ugandans had been banished from the streets and by the UN, so they had to come in, and they ended up saving this Doctors Without Borders doctor who was stranded in his hospital. The UN wouldn't come and save him, so the Ugandans had to rush in there and get him out. And once people saw this, they got really terrified. And they started flocking to the airport where the Ugandans were based, and they flocked there by the thousands until 2 days before the withdrawal, there were just thousands of people in there. It was like a massive refugee camp at this airport, and it was like this covered in this pall of cooking fire smoke, and the sanitation was awful because there was no toilets and there were no latrines. The UN wasn't coming and doing anything, and so there were people getting sick, and you would have these massive C-130s land, these UN C-130s. They would come in, they would float in like these flying nuns, these black and white planes, and they would leave empty, and people would see this and they would think, oh my God, we're gonna die, we're all gonna die, and because the Lindu were gonna come in, these people were Hema, and just these nightmares of Rwanda, these things coming up. People, I was terrified myself. I just knew it was coming, and so people, I think 4,000 people marched to the border of Uganda with the soldiers. They didn't want to stay, but any kind of plane that would land that week, people would fight. There would be a fight at the door for people to scramble on. Yeah. Mothers would just throw their children into these open doorways of these planes, and these planes that were going to Kinshasa, anywhere but Bunia. And I watched one woman, just be beaten in the head by this Ukrainian pilot. This old, because these Soviet Antonovs would fly in there all the time, and she finally just squeezed in with her baby, like through his legs, and was steel the board. But it was just pandemonium and utter madness. And when the Ugandans left, these people were killed. They were all killed. They're not all of them, but 500-600 of them.
What is the situation? We've got to wrap up here, between the Lindu and the Hema today.
Lindu and the Hema today are business partners. I came back there in 2004, 2005, 2006, and you realize that it wasn't ethnic really at all. we had it in our mind, and we were, you know, writing in our stories, mm-hmm. this is a tribal war, this is ethnic hatred and all that stuff. But it really wasn't. I think there was some of that in there. And it's what they told these young kids to get them to fight and to get them to kill people. But what it was a battle over taxation rights to these Ugandan trade routes. And Lake Albert separates Uganda and Congo. And so all the traders that come over by boat, they have to pay taxes to militia. And so, and there's all these gold fields up in Bunia. And that's what it was about. That's what it's about now. And so what you had in 2004, the Hema and the Lendu militia joined forces, and they fought the UN. And they're still fighting the UN. And it's all about money. It's all about loot and pillage. People die for nothing. They die for some kid to get, you know, his hand on a few grains of gold dust. And so what can we do? I don't know what we can do. We can say, when you go and you buy gold, you can ask your guy, the dealer, where this gold came from. Is it coming from Congo? It really worked to kind of stop that, the blood diamonds, the river of blood diamonds coming in from Sierra Leone, so maybe it can work with Congo. Mm-hmm. You can fund places like Human Rights Watch and Doctors Without Borders, because they're the only ones there kind of saving these dying kids from the bush, because the government can't be bothered.
Well, I'll never look at my cell phone the same way again.
It's true. We all carry a little bit of the Congo War with us.
Sure do. Brian, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Mueller is the author of All Things Must Fight to Live, Stories of War and Deliverance in Congo. The publisher is Bloomsbury. Look for him on the web at www.brianmealer.com. Brian, B-R-Y-A-N, Mealer, M-E-A-L-E-R.